You are tuned in to CITR 101.9 FM, and it is 1 o'clock on a Friday afternoon here in Vancouver, and it is time for Skulls Hall, and I am your host, Brian McDonald. And today, we have a couple of interesting guests. Coming up at the bottom half of the hour, we are going to have an interview with Robert Coleman. Robert Coleman is a poet based currently in Ontario near Toronto. However, he is down here in Vancouver this week giving a tour for his latest poetry collection called Little Empires, which came out last fall, and he's promoting it now here around the Vancouver area. And he does have some ties here. He is a MFA student here at UBC, actually. And he'll be in town for the next few days. And one of the things he did was stop on by earlier this week for an interview. So we'll be listening to him coming up at the bottom of the hour. To start off our show today, however, we are going to be joining the cast and, well, some of the cast and crew and production crew of the web series Standard Action. And this is a web series you can find on YouTube. They are just finished with their second season, and they are currently actually running a Kickstarter fundraising project in order to help them get ready to produce a third season, for this is not an easy thing. And Standard Action, by the way, is a locally produced web series. All of the cast and crew are here in the Vancouver area, and they are looking for our help in terms of helping them continue to create lovely art. And so we're going to be joining them in just a moment. We're going to start off by just hearing a little bit of a teaser, and just to bring us to the flavor of that, just remember, in the days when the oceans drank TSR, and before the rise of World of Warcraft, there lived an age undreamed of. And unto that age, Edda, whose destiny was to wear a troubled crown upon her brow, arrived. So let me tell thee of the days of high adventure here at CITR 101.9 FM.
Cedric? Cedric, could you come out? There are other people in the tavern who want to use the outhouse. You've been in there for over an hour. Baby, could we just talk about this, please? I know I'm not very good at talking about stuff. Yeah, you're right. I'm terrible at talking, but I'm ready now. Could you come out? I know you're in there. I'm sorry about everything that I said. I just got angry, baby. I mean, when I get angry, I say things that I don't mean. I love the fact that you're a wizard. I love the spells and the books and the reading and the way that you can make those hands that pick things up from a long way away, and you can make us look all clean when we're actually all covered in goblin blood. Yeah. And I really think that you are very courageous. Now, for a wizard. I meant the phrase flower-picking, kobold-livered, dress-wearing budgie in the most flattering way possible. I've met some very effective kobolds in my time. And budgies. Wow, have you ever been bitten by one of those little guys? It really, really hurts. And I know I broke your staff. And I'm sorry, but I really don't think that you can blame me for that. It is just a stick, and I am pretty ferociously strong. I was just expressing my feelings about the fact that you were hiding behind that tree during that entire battle with those rat people. I just don't know my own strength. The construction was obviously flawed. And I think you look great in powder blue. And in a dress. I mean robe. That powder blue robe that I bought you really looks great. I know that I got angry about the price, but you know how hard it is for me, honey, when I can't read the bill and then I have to get your cat familiar to read it for me. It just makes the whole process of paying 150 gold for a powder blue dress for your boyfriend just that much more humiliating. Robe. I meant robe. But you know, I can change. No, you know what? I will. I will change. I'll start training as a fighter. No more angry outbursts. I'll get myself a one-handed weapon and a shield and no more crazy barbarian charges into battle, I promise. I'll start eating with a fork. I'll learn to read. I'll bathe more often. I'll even get rid of that really horrible mock dire rhino wall hanging that you hate so much. Huh? What do you think? Look, are you kidding me? I mean, I'm pouring my heart out here. I mean, I don't get any respect from you. Here I am, trying my very best to be the best barbarian that I can under very difficult circumstances. Do you think that elvenkind really prizes people who get really angry and hit things? No, because you know what they do prize is people like you, who sit in outhouses reading books on how to more easily escape from imminent danger. I mean, why else would wizards have a spell called Expeditious Retreat? I don't even know what expeditious means, but I bet it means whenever possible. You know what? You are going to come out of that outhouse right now, or I am going to tear it down. Oh, that's it.
You are tuned in to CITR 101.9 FM, and this is Skald's Hall, and we are here with key members of the cast and crew of the web series Standard Action. We are here with Joanna Gaskell. Hello.
Hello.
And Rob Hunt.
Hey.
Tara Pratt.
Hello.
And Vanessa Drivness. So why don't we move on to our first question. What is Standard Action?
Standard Action is a fantasy comedy web series. So we are we're completely online. We have two seasons online right now. The second one just finished releasing. We are very much sort of for nerds of all ages and all kinds. We are very sort of tongue-in-cheek humor. We're completely filmed here in Vancouver with a small crew and an indie budget, and we are looking to fund our third season right now. You can find us at standardaction.com.
And how did Standard Action get started?
I guess I'll feel that. I'm really passionate about filmmaking, and I love doing it. It's going to happen no matter what. So I was making my second feature, and we were doing some pickup shoots of a scene we had to add because an actor had dropped out of the project, so we had to create some more scenes. And we were working with Edwin Perez. We were standing around, and finally we admitted to each other that we all played D&D, because D&D players, some of us are a bit secretive. It's not something we like to be super proud of in normal day-to-day life. And so, yeah, we're talking to Edwin, and he's like, yeah, I play board games on Sunday nights. And we're like, oh, we play board games on Monday nights. Well, what game do you play? He's like, Dungeons and Dragons. At that point, Joanna actually, she busted out these scripts that she'd been working on, which were based around Dungeons and Dragons characters. And Edwin pulls out his cell phone, his iPhone, and actually has pictures of him in a Frodo costume from Lord of the Rings. He's like quite the talented costumer, we all decided to get together and make a web series.
That pretty much tipped the scales, really. I mean, having a bunch of fantasy web series scripts written is one thing. Actually making it happen is something entirely different, because when you try to do something in fantasy, you hit a whole lot of snags that have to do with the way a fantasy series is supposed to look. So art and props and costumes and that kind of thing. And we didn't actually think we were going to be able to make the show. I just sort of wrote the scripts for fun. And it's just sort of the people that we met along the way that allowed us to actually bring it to life.
Were the characters or storylines that you guys wrote based on any specific characters or campaigns that you gamed through?
Not specifically campaigns. I mean, the character of Fernando the Bard was loosely based on one of Rob's characters, actually, whose name was Ronaldo. And Ronaldo actually ends up being Fernando's father in the series. And he was a bard.
Yeah, I actually played a bard once where I built the whole character around a picture of Errol Flynn as Robin Hood. And I'm like, that's my bard. That cocky smile, that's him right there. So it sort of carries on with Fernando's character where he's really...
very dashing yeah. and kind of dumb. And the actual characters themselves are very much based on sort of D&D tropes. The classes themselves are sort of the four kind of complex classes. They're a little bit more complex to play, and therefore they were left out of the fourth edition of D&D. So when fourth edition was released, I saw that they left out these classes, and I was kind of, you know, disappointed by that, but I used it as inspiration to write these characters who were basically like the guys who were left out of the party. So that's where the inspiration for the characters came from.
How did each of you get involved in Standard Action?
Well, I got involved not quite at the very beginning, but right after Rob, John, and Edwin filmed the very first teaser episode of season one. Rob and I were actually working together on another set, and it was the same sort of thing where we accidentally outed each other as closet geeks. And so he was an indie filmmaker, and he had some stuff that he was working on that he gave me a disc to look at. And I'm a huge cosplayer. I love fantasy. I'm involved heavily in a lot of different fandoms online. I go to conventions. I love web series, and so I saw the first episode, and I got shivers. I was like, oh my god, I know so many people that would be like, would absolutely love this. I really want to be involved. I came back to see Rob the next day at work, and I was like, I ended up having coffee with Joanna, and I somehow managed to convince her that she couldn't live without me. I fill in where needed, and I do costumes, and I do a whole bunch of other stuff for the show. But it was one of those kind of, if we hadn't been working together, Rob and I, on that absolutely miserable, awful show, we would never have gotten to talk to each other, and I never would have been involved in the project. So it was as much as the actual gig was terrible, it brought us together, and it put me on the, definitely squarely in the Standard Action family. So that was fun. And Tara?
I got involved the good old-fashioned way. I saw the audition notice posted on, I believe it was Vancouver Actors Guide. It was posted in several places, I think. But I just saw the audition notice, and I just went out. I tried out for it. And I think despite Joanna's initial vision for Guinevere, which was as a blonde, because Joanna, of course, is brunette. She wanted to kind of change it up. But, you know, I gave it a shot anyway, and here I am. So I must have done something right.
Yeah, we were very specific. We were like, okay, blondes and redheads for Joanna's character, for sure. So it's like, no more brunettes. There's brunettes everywhere. But Tara was just too good. So
I was going to say, you know, and the $20 helped too, right?
Oh, yeah. Sliding it across the table, for sure.
Yeah slick.
In a series as complicated as this, what is the pre-production process like? The first season was like a 14-episode story arc. Did you have that all worked out before you began filming it?
Oh, for goodness sakes, no. Oh, no.
It was supposed to be like 3 episodes.
Well, we had no idea how far it was going to go. No, it certainly wasn't planned. I mean, the general arc was planned, for sure. Like, by the time we got to the point where we figured, okay, we're actually going to make this series, which was about, I don't know, I wrote the first 4 episodes, and then we shot those, and we were like, okay, all right, we can keep doing this. By about episode 5, I knew where it was going to end, generally. But I didn't know how long it was going to take. A lot of the characters, when the actors took on their roles, they really brought something unique and interesting to the characters, and that inspired me to take those characters in different directions. A lot of the stuff certainly wasn't planned. Stuff would come up during the course of the season where all of a sudden we'd have access to some resource that we didn't know we had, and therefore just decide to use it. Yeah, no, it was very, very dynamic. The whole process was not particularly planned. I have people coming up to me now who are saying, I have this web series idea and I want to make it in a year. what should I do to market it, promote it, build it up, build a fan base, all this in the next year before I get it going. And that's so fantastic. And we did none of that. Like, nope. None of it.
We did it completely backwards. Like, we just started making it and putting it out there and then calling in, making all of our friends watch it. And just, because it was really good, and I had some connections and some other people had other connections and other fandoms, we got following. And we were crazy surprised. We're like, holy crap, people like us and they watch us and know who we are. Guess we should make more. And we just kept going from there. So season one, there was no reaction. As a customer, I would get the script a week, maybe two, before we'd shoot it.
Yeah, very dynamic filming.
What about the post-production process? What was that like?
It was part of the reason I wanted to do standard action, and I was really willing to give it a try, is because I love doing visual effects. I'm not particularly good at them, but I love doing them.
That's not true.
So, it was like, part of it was like, yeah, I want to do fantasy. We'll do magic because I can do that. Because what happened is that I actually have a degree in computer science. So I'm a software developer by day. When I was over in England and Joanna was getting her master's degree in acting, I was working for a web development company. And I was working with Adobe Flash, which is like how you make like interactive experiences on the internet. And it's sort of obsolete now. But while I was working with that, they had this really neat technique where they could generate really cool sparkles and animations in After Effects, which is another Adobe product. And you could export that and put that in your Flash movies, and it would look really cool. From then, I found tutorials on how to do really cool effects, like making people's heads explode in After Effects with just like a Handycam. And it looked really cool, and I started shooting stuff like that and playing around in After Effects. And then I just did color correction in After Effects. And that's how you get a really high-quality image, even from something like a DSLR camera, which is what we shoot with. I basically work wholly within the Adobe series, so I edit in Adobe Premiere, and I do my visual effects and color correction in After Effects. In second season, we were really lucky. We got Kirsten Tennert, and he actually was our boom operator on set, and he also did all of our audio post-production and music for second season. For first season, we had a lot of stock music, but we also got a lot of custom composed music from our friends. In our pilot episode, actually, the guy who plays Mortimer the Magnificent, Merchant, he actually made the standard action theme song and like a techno remix after shooting with us. He just like went home and was super inspired. And we actually got another track that way where we had another musician who was Phyllis Ho, and she was a halfling bard who played the fiddle in episode eight.
Yeah.
And she, after filming with us, went home and the next day recorded a fiddle version of our standard action theme, and she gave that to us. So we got some really neat music that way.
We are very, very lucky to draw in awesome people who are incredibly talented. One of the things that has really worked for us on set, both in post-production and in production, is basically bringing in talented people and giving them creative freedom. It just sort of like, as long as you sort of give them an outline as to what you need and just letting these creative people make amazing things, and you end up with fantastic stuff. And I know Ashley isn't here in this interview right now, but that was, you know, she's an example of that just as much as Vanessa is or Rob in the special effects. Is basically, we need something basic, and then these amazing talented people decide to just take it so much further than I could ever ask for as a producer.
I was just wondering, you guys film in what appears at any rate to be a wilderness. What sort of challenges do you face while shooting?
Paintballers?
Yes, dirt bike.
Sorry, that was probably all of it.
It's wilderness, but it's not true wilderness.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, most of the stuff that you see in first season is all sort of the same location shot from different angles. And second season is kind of the same as well. It's actually a relatively small area. We just shoot the crap out of it. You can sort of use a lot of different angles of the same area and get a lot out of it. And we tend to do that so that we don't have to go really, really true wilderness. Like, we don't have to really bushwhack an awful lot, just because then you do end up with problems like not being anywhere close to a washroom and not being close to a warm place if it's raining, because it's often raining.
Most film days it rains.
Yeah, for sure.
The actual location is super remote. It's for first season, part that we actually walked to from our makeup artist's house. And then quite a bit of second season was just a short drive from our makeup artist's house up into a private area. So it looks like we are miles away from civilization. It's like a 10-minute drive. It's not bad.
What sorts of things have you learned about film production in general by running this series?
I've learned that a lot of what was thought to be, a lot of what was common practice 5 years ago is going to be changing radically, and is going to be changing even more in five more years. There are new technologies coming out. You can do motion tracking with the Microsoft Kinect and animate 3D characters with it, and it's a $99 camera. It's not anything fancy and expensive. We're going to see like an amazing, like it's going to be like the time when suddenly anybody could have a book published, is you're just going to see this amazing tide of great content coming to the web. And it's going to be, some of it's going to be very surprising. It's going to be very exciting over
the next
5 years.
We're already seeing a lot of that. I mean, the fact that the technology that we use on Standard Action is incredibly affordable.
Yeah. We use Canon T3Is. They're like $500 cameras.
Yeah, now you can get them for $500. Yeah. And our sound stuff is really cheap.
Yeah, our sound stuff is like a $200 microphone and a $300 audio recorder. And it's just all the, and you know, the computer I edit on is only $800. And that's actually like a really good, fast one. You can get better ones. Like, you can get cheaper, more budget ones.
So you mentioned at the beginning of the interview your Kickstarter campaign. Can you tell us a little bit about how that came to be?
Yeah, for sure. We run an Indiegogo campaign for second season. Indiegogo is another crowds, possibly you've heard of Indiegogo. A lot of Canadians use Indiegogo. Canadians can't use Kickstarter unless you have an American bank account. So we tend to turn to Indiegogo for crowdfunding. And we used that for our second season. And it was fantastic. It worked really, really well for us. We probably made about a half of our budget out of that Indiegogo fundraiser from our second season fundraiser, which was amazing.
And that was actually our third Indiegogo fundraiser that we've ran. The first two failed, but we still were successful
with
the money we
raised. But
they weren't
for Standard Action.
No, they weren't. They were for other projects.
Yeah. And then the Kickstarter thing, yeah, we met Ed Healy, who's a guy from a company called Gamerati. They are out of Washington State, and they decided to pair up with us to run our Kickstarter. And since they're an American company, we were able to run a Kickstarter rather than an Indiegogo. And that was a big choice for us because Kickstarter has a whole lot more visibility. A whole lot more people on it.
We'd already filmed a bunch of Indiegogo videos and come up with all the text, and
we had to change all those. But yeah, it was a really sort of ambitious but really solid choice for us to make, I think, and it's turned out quite well for us. Canadians can back Kickstarter accounts, absolutely. You just can't run one.
And so that's still ongoing right now, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I think we have 20 days left.
And we actually have some really exciting features to it. One of the things we're going to be doing is we're running a Choose Your Champion contest. And what that means is that for every $10 you donate, you get votes at the end. And everyone's going to vote for their favorite of the four leads. And since Joanna hasn't written the third season yet, and since we're used to this organic process, we'll be able to make sure that the chosen character features a lot more heavily in season three.
That was one of the things that actually... The origins of crowdfunding came from a lot of that sort of thing. Like a lot of the very early crowdsource fundraising came from people basically voting with their dollar towards specific things in a project or a production that they wanted to see more of. I think the original one came from theater, didn't it, Robbie? You were talking about that?
Some theaters found that they raised more money when they had nights where there would be like all these different things that people could donate money towards. Like, oh, we're running Hamlet in our second play of the season. You can donate to Hamlet's costume or, you know, different lead characters, or you can donate to like the product, like specific plays or the set.
So giving fans the ability to actually vote with their backing dollars is kind of a cool idea, and I don't think it's really used enough in Kickstarters and in Indiegogo. So we're giving it a go. See how popular it is.
Do you guys have any advice for upcoming writers, directors, actors, costume designers who might want to try a similar project?
Be realistic about what you can accomplish. It's always very tempting to write something that's huge and amazing and epic. You have to be brutally honest with yourself with what you can feasibly shoot and produce and release and have it still look good and still be true to your story without looking like complete and total amateur or like you don't know what you're doing or have it look really crappy and underfunded and very, very bad.
The best thing I can say to people who want to start a web series is I actually had a friend I was talking to today about starting his web series. And there's two big things. They're kind of practical, but one of them is you should get yourself a camera as soon as possible. They've never been cheaper, and filming and how it, looking through the lens, it's, you know, it's something that you just get by taking pictures and shooting video clips and just understanding how it works. Even as a person who would be in front of the camera, I've seen Joanna grow as an actress by helping with the editing and the filming. So yeah, get like something like a T3i for like $600 or $700. It comes with a kit lens, and you can start learning about how different lenses work. And yeah, like that's just getting started. I meet a lot of filmmakers who don't even have a camera, and it just baffles me. And the next thing I could say is if you're really serious about making a web series, I would strongly think about making something like a comedy or like a campy comedy like what we do. I see a lot of web series be very serious, and some of them do it okay, but a lot of them fall really short when they're trying to be really serious. And if you do something funny, like if you look at shows like Red Dwarf or a lot of British shows, you know, since they have this comedic element, they can still have big storylines, but a suspension of disbelief that allows the viewer to forgive things like Converse shoes or, you know, like modern...
Hey, Converse shoes was a choice.
Yeah, yeah. But stuff like that, like a campy comedy makes it so much more forgiving that all, you know, like for comedy isn't... It makes your effects not have to be as good. So those are my main two points is get a camera and think about doing a comedy first or a lighthearted thing because it'll look better in the end.
One of the things that I see in a lot of people who are planning a web series or have a great idea, even have like a script for a feature, even anything like that, who are just trying to launch into a project like this, a big thing that I see handicapping a lot of people is fear of it not being perfect, is that sort of perfectionism that they're, you know, you write your dream script and then you want to make it look the way that it looks in your head. Well, one thing that a lot of people who are starting out have to learn, and they have to learn it quickly, is that it is never, ever going to look the way you think it's going to, the way you think it should look in your head. I mean, it's just never going to turn out that way, ever. The indie film and working on a budget the size of ours, you can't ever have anything perfect. Like, you can't ever have anything exact. You have to be very flexible. You have to take what you can get. You have to use what resources you have in the best way that you can. And you have to be really, really flexible. Like, never feel like you have to stick to plan A. I mean, plan A never worked in standard action. Most of the time we were working on like plan D or plan E. I wrote season 2 four or five times before what you see now as season 2 ended up online. Really go easy on your detail. Like, realize that you're going to have to change everything. Make a plan and then throw it away. Don't get paralyzed by you wanting it to be perfect, because you could edit something forever. I mean, you could edit something for months and it's never going to look the way you want it to look. At some point, you're going to have to let it go and let it live in whatever form it lives in. So it's okay. I think that's mostly what I want to communicate to people. It's okay. It doesn't have to be perfect. People will love it anyway if your heart's in it.
I just suggest that they make sure they choose a project that not only do they love, but that they love the company, the people they're working with. Because if they're doing anything like what we did, which was shooting, you know, starting at the butt crack of dawn and in all kinds of weather, you're going to be, your patience and your emotions are going to be tested. So you want to be with people that you enjoy spending time with at the end of the day, because they'll make up for whatever hindrances the weather and the environment present to you.
Our big push right now is the fact that we've just finished up a very beautiful, I'm very proud of our season 2. So I encourage anybody to go and check it out and maybe visit our Kickstarter. And if you're not the kind of person who funds a Kickstarter, that's cool. Tell your friends and maybe spread the word and share Standard Action with other people.
And my tip is to check out the $25 reward level on our Kickstarter. It's actually the sweet spot. What we've designed it to be is that as we reach stretch goals, people at the $25 level get all this crazy extra digital content. Like, we already hit a stretch goal where we are going to have a Pathfinder module, which is a version of D&D, made for Standard Action based on, is it between seasons 1 and 2?
That's the one we got. Yeah.
And so anyone who donates at the $25 level gets a PDF copy of that, as well as a whole bunch of other things, including music made by the musicians who help make Standard Action. And if we reach more stretch goals, there'll be another PDF of another Pathfinder adventure between 2 and 3, and that'll be included at the $25 level, and there'll be a lot more stuff.
Including a script of the Edda feature film backstory.
Yeah. Yeah, and a musical episode. If we make it to $33,000, we're gonna have a musical episode.
Wow. Yeah, surprise, Tara. We're doing a musical.
I know, it's not a surprise to me. I saw this, and all the I get dropped here and there. I'm like, oh, geez, okay, all right. Hey, you know what? I'll do it. You guys won't want to hear it, but I'll do it.
Yay! That's what I'm gonna do. Auto-tune.
This is Standard Action.
Well, thank you very much for your time. It was great to have you on our show.
Hey, thank you. I'm sorry that the technology was sticky, but hopefully it turned out okay.
Yeah. Yes. Thanks for having us on Scald's Hall.
Yes. Thank you, Brian. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed talking with you.
Yes, and you were listening to the cast and crew of Standard Action here at CITR 101.9 FM. Thank you very much again. You are tuned in.
At Dunkin' Donuts, each and every
radio show
is brewed fresh and served fresh at the peak of its flavor. If you're a tough customer, only the taste of this
radio show
will do. So go ahead, let Dunkin' Donuts make your
radio experience
exquisite.
Indeed.
Dunkin' Donuts, serving sweet treats from the pop underground. Thursdays, noon to 1.
ABC Short Film Makers, this 4th annual Vancouver Short Film Festival is now accepting entries until August 1st, so get those cameras rolling. The student recent grads and professional filmmakers can submit films and videos, and remember, the shorter the better. Last year 29 short films were screened, and over $15,000 in prize we were awarded to BC filmmakers. For entering rules and submit online, please visit the Vancouver Short Film Festival at vsff.com.
And you are tuned in to CITR 101.9 FM, and that was the interview with several members of the cast and crew of Standard Action. And I just want to once again thank Live Joanna, Rob, Vanessa, and Tara for tuning in for the interview and for putting up with the myriads of technical difficulties we had in our maiden voyage of doing Skype interviews here on Skald's Hall. But I believe it turned out very well. Just a couple of footnotes to that particular interview. Their Kickstarter project is still ongoing. It is at 13 days to go currently. So a little bit more time has passed, but it is still well within the time for people to check it out. Just type in Standard Action Kickstarter and you will get to the Standard Action Season 3 page. And you can check it out and you can donate fairly easily, provided that you use credit cards. It goes through Kickstarter uses Amazon payments. And so you tell Amazon about your credit card and then you can buy quote unquote Kickstarter pledges. It's not quite that simple. It philosophically works a little bit differently, but that's the nuts and bolts of doing a pledge in this day and age. It happens a lot and it's a great way to promote a lot of stuff that goes on. There are other Vancouver-based arts projects that use Kickstarter. You can do searches on the page based on your geography. The thing tracks where you are on the planet and automatically sets your web page, your homepage, if you sign up to show projects that are in your area. So I always get to see the Vancouver projects. It's really nice. And also, for more information about the show, you can go to their website. You could simply type in Standard Action and find it. It is standardaction.zombieorpheus.com. So Standard Action, all one word, no caps, .zombieorpheus, all one word, no caps, .com. And from there, you can find links to their cast and crew, links to other stuff that they love, links to the episodes, links to buying DVD sets of their first two seasons. Other various assorted merchandise. And so, and then they also have a lovely little hot link to their Kickstarter project in the corner of their homepage there. So you can see it there as well. So you can just go there. And as Joanna mentioned, even if you don't want to donate, by spreading the word, you can still do a world of good. We will be putting the Standard Action Kickstarter page as a hot link on our social media feeds here at Skulls Hall. You'll be able to see it on our Facebook and Twitter pages sometime later today. And so it will be a really good way to promote local talent. And it's a really great way to see things get made that otherwise have been abandoned by the quote-unquote big commercial ventures. So, like, if you were a gamer at all, you might have noticed that over the last year, entire swaths of video games from genres, entire genres that have been declared dead, even though there was nothing wrong with them, are finding a second life on Indiegogo and especially Kickstarter projects. In Exile and Obsidian Studios, for example, have recently, last fall for Obsidian and this winter for, or this late early spring for In Exile, ran multi-million dollar Kickstarters where they raised about $4 million apiece to make games that just won't get publishers, but obviously have an audience because they got this money funded in nickels and dimes from just average people. So if you're a fan of something that just doesn't get made anymore by the big boys, take a look at places like Indiegogo and Kickstarter for projects that you feel ought to be made. Or if you're feeling particularly adventurous, and I hope that you are, start one yourself. Starting an Indiegogo project's not that hard. Indiegogo's a little different. With Kickstarter, you set a target goal, and if you don't get that target goal at the end of your time, nothing happens. No pledges. You get no money. People spend no money. At Indiegogo, you get whatever people give you. Which can be both good and bad. So, like, if you promise something and only get a fifth of your budget, well, you've got the fifth of your budget, and now what? But if you're ready for that, then you can do it that way, too. And the nice thing is you do it, get at least something. So it's pay-as-you-go with Indiegogo, and with Kickstarter, it's all at once. Both services take fees. With Kickstarters, you lose, like, 8%, I think. Amazon fees take 3 to 5, depending on the project percent, and Kickstarter itself takes 5%, and so they make a small fortune off of the video game revival. They made like a small fortune off of that, seriously. And you also find a lot of stuff like there was a D&D Kickstarter, a D&D not game, but like a documentary about the history of D&D that was Kickstartered a few months ago. And was saved actually by the CEO of Pathfinder, who's now one of D&D's. They used to work together. Pathfinder, the people who make Pathfinder used to work for Wizards of the Coast. Like they did the Dragon magazine for a long time. Dungeon. I used to subscribe to both once upon a time when they were printed on paper. They did the Dungeon magazine for a while, and they did some of their supplements, but now they're competitors. And so one of D&D's biggest competitors saved a documentary about D&D, interestingly enough. But like that kind of stuff happens on Kickstarter, so you might want to check it out. Okay, we are going to go on to listening to Rob Coleman. So here he comes on CITR 101.9 FM and Skulls Hall. You are tuned in to CITR 101.9 FM, and we are here with a very special guest, Rob Coleman. Good morning, Rob.
Good morning, Brian.
And how are you today?
Very well, thank you.
And you've come to us from quite a distance, isn't that right?
That's right. I flew in from Toronto a few days ago to promote my newest book of poetry called Little Empires.
Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm a poet part-time, writer and editor for another magazine, and that's pretty much what I do.
How did you get started in the life of poetry?
Well, I've always been fascinated by language and poetry in particular, all through school and that sort of thing. But it was when I took a course at the age of 30 and someone actually said I could do it and I was good at it that I was inspired to push it further.
And what kind of influences did you have on your work? Who or what inspired you as a poet?
Great poets like Dylan Thomas, modern poets like Mark Doty, people who have a unique style and a way of expressing themselves that was new to me and spoke a truth that couldn't be done with just everyday language.
And have you done any formal training towards becoming a poet?
Funnily enough, not before I published my first book. I'm now in the optional residency MFA program here at UBC. That's new to me. It's very exciting to actually have that that structure for the first time in my brief career.
Can you tell us a little bit about the optional residency MFA program?
Sure. It's basically taking courses online and working with other students to further your art and get at the heart of what you need to improve and basically, you know, create even better work than you've done before.
Did you have any assistance or support from the people or the environment around you as you transitioned into becoming a poet?
It's a funny thing. I met a lot of new people when I started working on my poetry seriously. But there's always lots of support. There's always lots of other people who wanted to gather to discuss work and basically workshop poems in my community and the community of poets I found in Toronto. So there's an incredible amount of support that you can find once you start going to a lot of poetry readings and hearing other people's work and starting to understand who you can learn from and gain experience from.
And what was the writing and publishing process like for your first book, which came out a few years ago?
I've always wanted to publish a book of poetry, but the end point was never really in sight during the writing process. I just tried to write the best poetry I could and work it and edit it as I went. And that was the main concern I had, was just to write good poetry. It was only later on where I showed the poems to someone else and they said, "We think you have a book here." So it was a very relaxed process. It took me a long time. It was, well, not that long. It was probably about 5 years, but it was fairly relaxed because it was more about the work than the process of publishing itself.
Did anything change in your approach when you decided to start your second book?
Again, I tried to think of simply writing the poems initially, and then once I felt that there was a theme forming, that's when I started to consider it possibly publishable. Interestingly enough, the first few times I sent out the manuscript, it was not the manuscript that ended up being published. A lot of new poems were written, a lot of improvements were made to the work, and it was a gradual process of understanding what I really wanted this book to do that took me there. And it still took 4 years to make it the book that I wanted it to be.
Was the publishing process different for the second book?
Yeah, I think it always is. Once you've published in a lot of journals, which I did before the first book came out, and continue to do so in the process of working on the second book, people get to know you, so you have a lot more contacts and people you can bounce ideas off of. You know more publishers, and they're more aware of your work. So it's never easy to get a book published, but it's certainly a more receptive audience sometimes.
What kind of difficulties in particular did you encounter in getting your first two books published?
I think it's just the competition out there from so many great writers. So there's so many people out there who are published and incredible and worth being published that when you're the new kid on the block, you have to prove yourself. And the main way to do that is to get published in journals across Canada and anywhere else you can, to be honest. Publishers like to see that your work is out there and it may be developing an audience even before they see it.
What is your work about?
Okay, the first book is called The Delicate Line. It was published with Exile Editions in 2008. And it was, I like to call it a late coming-of-age story, which a lot of first books are, but just about very personal poems about my life, essentially. My second book, Little Empires, is published by Quattro Books. The name Little Empires came from the themes that evolved when I was writing the book, and it's really all about the safe places we create in work, at work, at home, and within ourselves to really make it through tough times or just change. A lot of this book was written during, you know, 2008, 2009, when we were all, you know, the economy was in a bit of a mess. You know, work was a difficult place to be, but it was also a time when I met my wife. We were developing our relationship at the same time, so it was a really interesting combination of concepts that came together when I was writing this book.
Did you find this difficult at first to share with others?
Not really. I always write fairly personal poems, and it becomes less about my own experience as the editing process continues, and it becomes more about the art and creating poems that resonate with other people. And I also used, metaphor and other writing techniques to create something that is so much beyond me that the personal is just one aspect of that.
When you sit down to write a poem or even an anthology, how do you go about it?
It's funny because it's changed with each book. The first book was really just writing lots of poems and then finding the theme later on. The second book was realizing sort of halfway through the process that there were a few themes that I wanted to explore. And so they found their poems, the themes found their poems in my day-to-day work. Like, for instance, one day I was reading a biography of a Chinese scientist from the 20th century, and that reminded me of my boss at the time. They were sort of evil in a similar way. Or that's the way I perceived it when I was reading this book, and it just lent itself to an exploration of that through poetry and trying to understand these characters that I'm reading about or thinking about. Well, I rarely just sit down to write a poem. I just sit down to write down my thoughts, and they take me where they need to go. I rarely try to force that.
Do you do a lot of editing afterwards?
Yeah, I do more editing than I do writing, I think, and that becomes more the case the more I write and the more I know. You know, the more I read of other people's work, the better I understand it, the more I want to make my poems work that much harder and seem as effortless as the really great poets are able to do.
How was promoting your first book different than what you're doing this time around?
I think I was a little shy to promote my first book. I didn't know a lot of people, and I knew a few reading series in Toronto and a couple other towns close by. So I just promoted them where I could through who I could. I have a publisher who is also a really great writer, and he's been really enthusiastic about the fact that I'm willing to travel wherever to get the word out. So just taking it on because I realized that's the only way it's ever going to happen. And I just love visiting new cities and getting to know people in different cities and getting to know the poetry in different places, because poetry across Canada is so varied, and the talent is so broad. It's great to be out here to see some of the talent out here.
And where will you be going to promote your work here?
I'm actually going to be out in Victoria on Friday nights at the Planet Earth Poetry Reading Series, which takes place at the Mocha House, 103-1633 Hillside Avenue. And then this Sunday, I'll be at the Vancouver Public Library on 350 West Georgia Street in the Alma Van Dusen Room at 2:30 in the afternoon. That's May 5th. With a great slate of writers from my publishing house. My editor, Alan Breezemaster, is going to be there with his new book of poetry. Susan Helwig is going to be there with her new book of poems, The Cat Says. And Claudio Gaudio will be reading from his novel, Texas, at the reading in Vancouver. In Victoria, it'll be the three of us poets.
And if people are interested in getting a hold of your work, is there a way that they can purchase it?
Yeah, just Google Quattro Books. I believe the site's quattrobooks.ca, but it's available through there. It's available, Little Empires is available on Amazon and all those sites. And as an e-read, if you're a Kobo fan, widely available and easily found.
And one final thing, do you have any advice for any young or young at heart and upcoming poets?
I think the big thing is just to write and to edit and to share the work at open mics when you can, and try to get as much feedback as you can. And if you're really keen on publishing, don't be shy about it. Send to the literary magazines across Canada. We have a couple of great ones here in BC, of course. I'm sure you all know those. But there are tons of them across Canada, and sometimes the editors give great feedback. But even if they don't, it's just a matter of getting used to the idea of sending the work out, and getting used to the rejection, but also the excitement of the occasional acceptance, which is really great. But the main thing is just to write, to continue to develop your own work.
And you were listening to Rob Coleman here at CITR 101.9 FM. Don't go away. In just a moment, we're going to hear a sneak peek into some of his work. And
hi, my name is Colin. I worked construction for a lot of years. I was the first guy they called on a new job. Then the pain started. Started real small, hardly could feel it. After a while, it got so bad I couldn't bend over. Couldn't sit, couldn't drive. Every doctor I went to couldn't find nothing. One even said it was in my head. From there, I lost everything. 10 or 15 years went by, smoking weed and whatnot. I don't remember the last years at all. Some people caught me trying to climb over a bridge railing, got me help. Now, with the right meds, we've got the pain under control. I used to think drug use was a death sentence. I get life instead.
This message was produced by Columbian Center Society and Radio Malaspina in British Columbia.
Welcome back to us here at CITR 101.9 FM in lovely Vancouver. And we are here again with Rob Coleman. Hello again.
Hello.
And we're about to hear some of his work. So what are we going to hear first?
The first poem I'm going to read is it's wonderful. I didn't really talk a lot about my inspiration in the writing process, but it's wonderful where you can be inspired. I was in a used bookstore a while back and found a copy of Paul Durkin's book-length poem, Christmas Day. And Paul Durkin's a huge favorite of mine. But this was a tragic moment in a way, because there was an inscription in this book and it said, "Cha, I love you and always will." You know, 3 years after buying the book, it also became a poem, so I can't really complain. So this poem is called Cha, I Love You and Always Will. Cha, I love you and always will. An inscription writ by Linda, Christmas 96, foot of the first page of Paul Durkin's Christmas Day, his celebration of woman hunger and bromance. Each time you open it, this lost link, random failure incised in the copy you found, among other anxious voices papering a used bookshop. What made him sell her words? Unless Linda, a chancer, wrote her love a game of hide-and-seek, inscribing random tracts of that same block-letter sentiment. Would he find her words to him in a slim volume of pulp lust, Mao's persistent little red book, the instructive erotic wiles of Roses, Durkin's Pining Christmas, or the doorstopper novel so full of cha she was run through with cha hunger? Linda might still await the right man or woman, why not, caught short by bold statement. Half-inch square capitals so firm and orderly under Durkin's fragile skin. A woman who knows you're weak but worth your puddle, your red scarves of woe. She is waiting in the snow now, outside the cemetery, to hold your hand, knit you a hat, make love to you on your back, in the blizzard, in the mess you call your day. It is okay for her to date you, Christmas circa 2010. She has her convictions, she can show you, by heaven she will, cha be damned. And how you want her to, even now, how you do. This second poem, as I said, some of these poems came out of the downturn of 2009, and I, just like a lot of other people who were working those days, went through some days I didn't want to go to work. So this one's called Burnout. Sorry I'm late, boss, but my cat has learned a new trick, placing his paws on the arm of a chair, sphinx-like, staring out into the garden. No walling over squirrels, he leans into the stillness, that soft-eyed, focused concentration I never did master in Kung Fu. The feature would have been done, but I was distracted by a newspaper in the rain, not just wet but half-macerated, chewed by the deluge. It put me in that why-bother kind of mood. The online broadcast? The voice is clear, but would you believe I wore yellow, so close in the spectrum to green screen? The cropped me kept fading out like a recurring echo, never quite coming into focus. And I'll go on with a couple of other poems about work, mostly, although they come in funny forms. This poem is one of my favorites in the book. I was talking about this Chinese scientist. I read this book, and it was about it's a biography of this scientist, Dr. Chen. And he was a fascinating man, and the world had treated him rather cruelly, And in return, he treated some people cruelly. But it made me think about why people do what they do. The poem is called Dr. Chen Responds to His Biographers. Perhaps I should be proud, the silk weave of my career captured, embossed, sewn between covers. My life, an ineluctable arc of 20th century. McCarthy, missile proliferation, Mao muddied in political dreams. A corolla of condemnations, the dead flower of our great leap forward. Then, finally, a kind of ascension, qualified by accusations I had turned tail on friends, achieving only hollow heights. Of course I am angry. Understand survival is a skill, unlearning a chosen culture to embody the civic symbol until your shoulders loosen in the shell of this new self, though your lips taste bitter knowing. I did not write this story. That is your arrogance, believing in your linear code. I can't argue that from you, nor do I ask for pity. It made sense, family, safety, to want a simplified landscape, a mathematical world, basic equations ordering our lives. It had a kind of purpose, shouting the ugly sparrows from their perches, chasing them from every surface until they expired of fright, exhausted. You too will seem ridiculous in others' eyes, calling forth the fragile bones of ghosts, searching for some true history. This next poem started as a joke, really, but then I realized the person I was writing about actually had something to teach me, which is one of the beauties of poetry. It never really takes you where you think it's going to take you, and that's when it's really magical. Certainly for me, as a reader and as a writer, it's always exciting to find yourself in a place you didn't expect to be. And I also like to read it because it has a ridiculous title. It's called Flaming Hula Hoops for Peace. I'm washing dishes when your brother-in-law tells us his niece is traveling the world, twirling flaming hula hoops for peace. Wake up to you, she calls it, her troubadour's demand over a pounding soundtrack, her 20-year-old face a wobbly glow of bliss. We watch it online. I think of the seventh seal, the knight's attendant traipsing wisdom about death's door. Her uncle worries that it's on the internet, an indelible echo. I wash dishes all afternoon, each course of a family dinner demanding more soap and water. Cleanliness is essential in such a small house. We are bound to run out of cups. In my last school play, I forgot the lines to Beauty School Dropout, my white specter, silver buckled, shuffling up a series of stairs into a mumbled heaven and a VHS tape castmates made me watch just the once. Neither radical nor raucous, I remember overconfidence for just a second, and the falling back to self, flightless. No hold but my feet leading me out of character, out of myth. A myth needs to be outsized to last. I have set nothing of value on fire. I have washed a lot of dishes. I'll just read one more poem. This is something like a form called a guzzle, although it doesn't quite make it. But it's again, one of the wonderful things about poetry is you can be inspired by anyone. And we have a neighbor who has a child who has a drum kit. And that's pretty much all you need to know about this poem. It's called Local Politics. The dictator says he will die a martyr rather than leave his country. A neighbor's child negotiates his drum kit through our clapboard walls. Our friend Andrew's newfound isolation excites him, the code of the written word cracking in his hands. I tuck my lover into bed at 10:30, jimmy the latch of a new novel. Nights are sometimes a debate between youth and community. Here comes the solo. The dictator says over and over how much his people love him. Andrew says, what if the royal family were monkeys? Dressing them to our taste, they'd make a perfect circus. We could send a letter of complaint, but to what end? The cat closes his eyes to the tap-tapping, yawns, sneezes. Following his lead, we wrap him in a blanket, cut his nails, tidy the sharp edges. Thanks very much.
And thank you for sharing. And don't go away. We'll be right back here at CITR 101.9 FM. And welcome back to Scald's Hall. It is nearly 2 o'clock, and it is nearly time for Radio Zero with Tyler and Cam. And that will be coming up in just a few moments. In the interim, we will be doing a few minor chores, and we will be listening to a few tunes while they all set up. So stay tuned. Don't go away. We'll be right back here at CITR 101.9 FM to continue our lovely Friday afternoon with that strange warm yellow ball that's in the sky. What is that thing anyway?
There are a lot of things you're not allowed to grow in your basement in Vancouver. Vegetables are not one of those things.
SPEC and the YWCA are excited to introduce the Urban Farmer Field School. The UFFS provides hands-on training in sustainable agriculture, small farm business planning, and community food action.
Class instructors are experts in urban agriculture, food systems, and plant mind control. The integrated curriculum is divided between classroom theory and practical learning.
For more information, please visit the interweb and search for Farmer Field School at speec.bc.ca.